6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Good afternoon. This is A Public Affair. My name is Rebecca Kemble. I'm a writer for the Progressive Magazine and for the Wisconsin Citizens Media Co-op. I'm sitting in today for Alan Ruff, who is away on a mystery assignment. Today, we have a two-part show. For the first half hour, we'll be talking to journalist Bruce Murphy about the upcoming Supreme Court election, the race between conservative Justice Pat Rogensack and law professor Ed Falone. And in the second half hour, we'll be talking with Steve Horn, an investigative journalist with the DeSmog blog, about neoliberal education policy and the new appointment of Rebecca Blank, U.S. Commerce Secretary, as the new UW-Madison Chancellor. Alrighty, we'll get to some phone calls a little bit later, but first let's go to Bruce Murphy, who is an award-winning journalist. He's the editor of Milwaukee Magazine and author of the Murphy's Law blog. He's worked for multiple print, TV, and radio outlets as an investigative reporter over the years. And he has a new article out in the Isthmus, just out today, about Justice Pat Rogensack and the upcoming Supreme Court race. Bruce, welcome.
Thanks. Can I just correct one thing? I was the editor of Milwaukee Magazine for 7 years. I'm now the editor of UrbanMilwaukee.com, which is an online daily.
Oh, okay, great. And you're still doing your Murphy's Law blog?
Still doing the Murphy's Law blog and contributing to Isthmus at times.
Which you did today.
Exactly.
Which, great article, by the way, and it raises a lot of really good issues that probably most voters don't even realize are issues. So do you want to just give a brief overview of the article and we'll get into some substantive discussion of those issues?
Sure. I really think that I have to say that even as someone who follows the news very regularly and writes about it, I was surprised at just how involved incumbent Justice Pat Rogensack was in some of the troubles the Supreme Court has had in recent years. So we had the incident with David Prosser, where he was accused of physically going after Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and that investigation was ended as a result of recusal motions, which were started by Judge Pat Rogensack. So she was the first one to do it, and then the other conservatives joined her. And in essence, that ended the investigation of Prosser, even though there was probable cause, according to the Wisconsin Judicial Commission, to investigate Prosser. So that's one thing that Rogensack was very involved in. Another thing she was involved in was kind of watering down the rules so that justices have more freedom to rule in cases involving campaign donors rather than recusing themselves. And finally, she was involved. She was the one who wrote the rule that has now made the Supreme Court's administrative rules discussions secret, where they used to be open to the public and to the media. All of these things, I think, have contributed to the court being more dysfunctional and less transparent and more influenced by campaign donations. And that's really what the challenger Ed Falone is charging, whereas Rogensack is running as someone who has, you know, far more experience as a judge than Falone, who has never sat on the bench. So you have a classic incumbent campaign against an insurgent challenger.
And you mentioned in your article that she herself, her campaign to get on the court, she was sort of a non-traditional candidate at the time that she earned her seat, won her seat. Is that right?
Very much so. She ran a couple times that way. She ran first for the state Supreme Court as a when she was just a private lawyer. She ran proclaiming herself as the people's candidate. She lost. She then ran for the State Court of Appeals successfully, again as a non-judge. And then after serving as a State Appeals Court judge for 7 years, then she ran again for the Supreme Court, and that time she won.
So give us a sense of what are the interests that back her? Who is donating all of these tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars to her campaigns?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of the same kind of donors who donated to Scott Walker. I think for the last 10 years at least, most of the Supreme Court races have boiled down to right versus left. Groups like the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Realtors, people who organizations that support school choice, those would be the kinds of organizations that would be contributing to Rogensack's campaign. Whereas Fallone would be more likely to have contributions from unions, perhaps from trial lawyers. But it's worth noting that so far this is not looking like an expensive campaign because basically Fallone really doesn't have that much money.
And yeah, his campaign has been very, very low profile. And in fact, some people have called it, I wondered if he's running a stealth campaign. He doesn't even have bumper stickers.
That's what happens when you have no money.
Yeah.
I mean, they have released their first ad now. And their campaign says they'll have enough money to be on TV and run a respectable campaign. But
they've got 12 days.
Yeah, I don't know if that's really true.
Yeah. So getting back to the Prosser incident the incident itself was the result of really political pressures on the Supreme Court. Can you talk about that a little bit, about what prompted the interaction between Bradley and Prosser?
Well, there was a decision they were waiting on, and they were pushing for Abramson to release it.
I believe it was the minority opinion on the Act 10 case on overturning the Judge Sumi decision.
Exactly. And that was really involving the process by which the Act 10 was passed, not the actual nature of the substance of the law, which is still in the courts. But it was just the process by which they did it and whether they followed the open records laws and whatnot. But in any event, yes, they were waiting for the minority decision. Prosser and the conservatives went to Bradley's office, where Abramson and Bradley were, and they were, Prosser was demanding that they release the decision. And Abramson indicated that she hadn't finished her, her dissent yet. And tension sort of rose from there. And, the justices have all had some disagreement over what actually went on. So Rogensack has said, that I actually placed my body between Bradley and Prosser, and she didn't remember it the way Bradley said, which was that Prosser had his hands on Bradley's neck. But Prosser himself told the police that he had his hands on her neck.
Right, he said she ran into him. She put her neck in his hands rather than him putting his hands on her neck.
He said that, she was raising her hands as she approached toward him. The thing about it is one can certainly imagine different versions of what happened. But I think what's important, rather than arguing about all that, is that there was a legal process here. The Wisconsin Judicial Commission launched an investigation. Frank Gibble, someone who, a former assistant U.S. attorney with lots of experience on criminal cases, did an investigation and determined that there was probable cause to believe that Prosser had violated three different statutory violations of the Judicial Code of Conduct. So that complaint normally... The normal procedure is that that's just sort of a pro forma thing where it gets passed on to a panel of appeals court judges, and they do a hearing to determine if Prosser was in fact guilty. Well, that never happened because Rogensack and the conservative majority, rather than just doing the pro forma and passing it on to the appeals court, which is what normally happens, they declared that they had to recuse themselves because they weren't objective observers. To which Gimbel has replied, yes, that's exactly right. You were not objective observers, which is why you should pass this on to the appeals court, which has judges who are objective and could decide if Prosser was indeed guilty.
And so, but that didn't happen?
That did not happen. And the first person to recuse on this, it was Prosser who said, these justices should recuse themselves on this issue. Rogensack did it before Gimbel even had a chance to respond to Prosser's motion.
So what they recused themselves on was the decision to refer it to the appeals court?
Exactly.
So not even on the issue itself. And there was a lot of, as you said, you characterized Rogensack as, you know, having engineered all of these rules changes to reduce transparency in the court. And one of the things that happened as the result of this issue was that the sitting chair of the Wisconsin Judicial Commission, John Dawson, was not reappointed as chair over the objections of some of the other justices. That's just another little piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, that I'm not actually aware of.
Yeah, that happened in 2000 last year, as a sort of a punitive action against the chair of the commission who decided to go forward with the complaint.
What I have heard is that, you know, sort of third hand, is that some members of the commission have since told Gimbel that he should be quiet.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So 256-2001, if you want to call and ask Bruce Murphy any questions about his latest investigative report on Justice Rogensack and or the upcoming Supreme Court race. Now, one of the points you make in your article is that Rogensack is sort of the leader of the conservative bloc and is typically the one who makes the first moves to, as in this, the Prosser case, to recuse herself. But she's also an opinion leader on other issues as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think originally what was probably the case is that Prosser was actually the most important member of the conservative bloc, but obviously he's, as a result of this whole incident, and he also had a run-in with Abramson where he called her a bitch. I don't know if I can say that in the air, but
I just did.
But so he's really, I just think his credibility has declined a bit. And meanwhile, Rogensack has more experience than Justices Ziegler and Gabelman. And I think she's kind of risen to the fore, and there's a tremendous a high degree of agreement between Rogensack, Ziegler, and Gabelman. So they often tend to take their lead from her, it appears. And that's what lawyers who've practiced before the court have suggested to me. So she's really become a key person. I mean, actually, one attorney said to me that in many ways she's the de facto Chief Justice. She's got more power than Abramson because that four-member conservative bloc can pretty much decide any case.
And, you know, in my observations over the last 2 years, that conservative bloc on the Supreme Court really is the ace in the hole of the Walker administration and the legislative Republicans, who seem to operate on the premise of, you know, we can break the law, we can push our policies through and break the law and depend on the Supreme Court to vote in our favor. Should it come to that, which, you know, was borne out by the decision of the Supreme Court in the Prosser case, where they decided that the legislature is indeed above the law and that they don't have to follow their own law. And so this the Supreme Court, the conservative bloc on the Supreme Court, really wields an enormous amount of power.
Well, it does. And You know, as far as the Walker thing, I mean, to me, the critical issue is they have not ruled on. The Republicans asked the court to consider the Act 10 in terms of the, you know, there are a couple cases there regarding the substance of Act 10 and whether it's constitutional. And the Supreme Court declined so far to do that. And one theory is that they didn't want to take that on before Rogensack was reelected. But in any event, it's ultimately going to be taken on by the Supreme Court, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, it's also there are also cases in federal court as well. So you're thinking that if she wins in 2 weeks, that they might decide to take up some of those cases?
Well, I think ultimately they're going to. The thing is, I think it would look odd if they, the Republicans had wanted them to just bypass the lower courts and take the case immediately. They declined to do that. And since they declined to do that before Rogensack's reelection, I think it would look really questionable if they suddenly decided to do it after she was reelected. So I have to believe that they'll wait until the lower courts make their decision, and then it'll go up to the Supreme Court.
Okay, all right, we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
I think that's myself.
Yep.
Hi there. This is all extremely interesting, the structure of all the interlocking activities. My question is about a little bit of history. I am reminded that something I read said that Mr. Prosser had a history of emotional outburst or, let's say, instability or failure to control his temper, say it different ways, whatever. If that's true, was that brought before Rogensack and that history, those allegations, and what was her response? I'll hang up and listen on the air.
Yes, that was another thing where the conservative bloc really has kind of been deaf to that issue. It's worth noting that Justice Patrick Crooks, who is the one swing justice on the court and actually tends to lean to the right, but he has on anything involving Prosser, has tended to side with Abramson and Bradley. And and Crooks told investigators that Prosser had emotional outbursts and would pound the table, and he felt really needed some kind of counseling. Crooks also went with Bradley to a court official to suggest that something needed to be done about this. And it was Crooks who suggested to the justices that some kind of counseling should occur with respect to Prosser, and the three conservatives, along with Prosser, of course, rejected the idea, so nothing came of it.
256-2001, if you'd like to join the conversation with Bruce Murphy talking about the Supreme Court race. I'm Rebecca Kemble, sitting in for Alan Ruff today on A Public Affair. Money in politics and the political nature of this job. I've been covering the joint finance hearings, and this morning Chief Shirley Abrahamson was sitting in front of the committee really pleading for the life of the Wisconsin state court system, saying, you know, these budget cuts that you're imposing upon us, and that the statutory lapses are going to make it so that we can't actually carry out the constitutional and statutory duties of the court. We literally will not be able to pay for the statutorily required staff that we have in our court systems. And some of the Republicans on the committee were saying, well, you know, you have to, the law of the land is we have to balance our budget, and the law is that we cut your budget. So it's a really highly politically charged situation that the court is in itself on all kinds of levels. Can you speak about that, about budget cuts to the Supreme Court and how that would affect the actual carrying out of justice in the state?
You know, I'm not sure. It's interesting that, I mean, that's Abramson's role, is to advocate for the courts and to advocate for their budget. And obviously she's a, you know, very powerful, very smart person, but I just don't know what the impact would be of that. And obviously, every two-year budget, there's always questions of where cuts should occur and not occur. I mean, you know, you've got the schools, you've got the UW system. This time around, it looks like the UW system is going to do better. But I don't know that that's necessarily an attack on the courts. It's hard to say. It could just be about, you know, who gets cut this time around, and that's always going to happen every 2 years.
Talking about Justice Pat Rogensack and her bid to retain her seat on the Supreme Court.
You know, you'd ask about money, and I was also thinking of, to me, the bigger issue with respect to money in the courts is just the issue of campaign contributors. And so you had the court ruling, in a ruling written by Rogensack, that the fact that you have a campaign contributor who's a party to a case doesn't necessarily mean a justice should have to recuse themselves. And that rule was actually written and suggested by the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. So the four conservative justices adopted a rule as written by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and the Realtors Association. And those groups had given millions to some of these very justices, Ziegler, Gabelman, and Rogensack. Ziegler, Gabelman, and Prosser. And so here you have them accepting this rule by these groups that had given millions to elect these folks. It just seems like you could hardly have a more egregious example of the power of campaign donations.
Hence the comment that there's the perception for the public is that the court is for sale, which
yes,
in some ways...
Which is what Fallone claims.
Right, right. That you mentioned that in your article.
And actually there are polls suggesting on a national basis that people tend to think that that's true.
Yeah. Okay, we're winding up our half hour with Bruce Murphy, who's got a new extensive article out in the Isthmus. It's also online at, is it thedailypage.com? Is that the website where it's online?
That would, the Isthmus, I'm sure we'll have it up there eventually at thedailypage.com, and you can also find it at my publication in Milwaukee, urbanmilwaukee.com.
Urbanmilwaukee.com. Okay, thank you very much, Bruce, for joining us today, and it'll be interesting to see how Fallone's campaign ramps up, if it does. Do you have any closing comments for us?
Well, other than I just think it's a really important race, and it hasn't gotten much play so far, and I hope that all people will get out there and vote.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. This is Rebecca Kemble sitting in for Alan Ruff today on A Public Affair. I'm waiting to be joined by Steve Horn, a research fellow for the DeSmog blog. He's also worked as a reporter and researcher for the Center for Media and Democracy. He and I have an article out today in the Progressive magazine about the appointment of the new chancellor to the UW-Madison, Rebecca Blank. The article is called Free Market Champion to Take Over as UW-Madison Chancellor. What we're going to talk about is really the neoliberal education agenda in Wisconsin and also more broadly nationally and internationally. And, you know, by neoliberal agenda, what we mean is basically the blind faith in free market solutions to solve all of our problems and to take care of even what were once considered public goods like education and healthcare and whatnot. Steve, do we have you on the air?
I'm here.
Hey, Hey, Steve, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. So we did a little bit of research into the background of our new UW-Madison Chancellor, Rebecca Blank, and came out with an article today in the Progressive, progressive.org. Do you want to talk about a little bit about what you found out about her?
Sure. So I think Blank's an interesting character, first of all, because this is not the first time that she has been a candidate to become the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin. This is the second time. The first time was when Chancellor Biddy Martin became chancellor. She was also in that pool. She was considered the favorite, but I think just because of some inside dealing, Martin became the chancellor. And as we discussed in the article, Martin didn't last too long, and that relates to a lot of stuff with kind of the agenda that Blank is pushing was not very popular at University of Wisconsin. So Blank's background is basically a longtime Democratic Party insider, been high up in the Clinton administration economic advisors committee. She did that for while Clinton was president. And then while Bush was president, she worked for the Brookings Institute, which is sort of another, it has a nice public face, but also pushes a lot of neoliberal type of agenda, basically. If you look at who funds it, it's still a lot of multinational corporations or people who work at corporations. And then she left Brookings, worked in Michigan for a while as a dean in their public policy school. And then, importantly, she went to work for the Obama administration. And we can talk about this more later, because the Obama administration is pushing, people who are close with the Obama administration are pushing all the same agenda that's being pushed in Wisconsin with the Walker administration. And while working there, she moved her way up to being his the head of the Department of Commerce. That says a lot about sort of who she is and what does the Department of Commerce do. Well, it serves business, basically, big business. So she moved her way up to the head of that department, and now years later she is the new chancellor of University of Wisconsin-Madison when all kinds of neoliberal type of reforms are being pushed. They're huge push for that under Martin's reign as chancellor with the New Badger Partnership. And although people saw that as a victory, there's been a lot of underhanded ways in which pieces of the New Badger Partnership are still being pushed to this day, including, I think, the biggest part, which Blank is completely in line with, and so is the Walker administration. That's the skills gap agenda, so to speak, which goes all the way to the top at the World Bank. It's agenda being pushed around the world in different countries where universities and K-12 schools are being used sort of as training grounds for certain sectors that they deem important, and everything else besides these sectors, be it oil and gas, be it some sort of rare earth minerals mining, you name it.
Defense manufacturing.
If it's not in line with that, then it's not, under this agenda, it's not really a form of education. So that means things like, things that teach critical thinking skills. And Blank even openly admits that. You look at her statement, she says, well, number one, the university is important because it produces research, and that means, scientific research or research in service to big corporations. And it's also important for this skills gap type of thing of training the next era of workers. So she never said anything about teaching critical thinking skills or anything like that. That's kind of an aside. Maybe if there's some funding for that, that will still be on the agenda. But the real agenda is this skills gap neoliberal agenda, which is the dominant agenda in the United States right now.
Right, and essentially turns public institutions into the research, development, and training arms of some of these big private corporations.
Exactly, and it's important to look at, I don't think a lot of people may like to look at University of Wisconsin-Madison in that way, but it's increasingly becoming an offshoot of basically corporate research parks. I mean, there is actually a UW Research Park, which partners up with a lot of corporations, and that may be what people think of as the sort of corporate partnership, but also just general labs on campus. We look at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. There's a recent article in Counterpunch that called Monsanto University, and the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation was mentioned in that in terms of teaming up with Monsanto to basically create patents that are used for their seeds, which are creating all kinds of havoc, especially in Africa, but it all over the world to push the big agribusiness agenda. So University of Wisconsin is completely complicit with that, and all signs point to Blank being a proponent of that, just like Biddy Martin was before her, and just like Donna Shalala was. It's basically, if you look at Blank, it's not so much Blank as Blank, but it's Blank is a proponent of these things. There's a proven track record. She worked under the Clinton administration. I mean, she was there for the NAFTA, when NAFTA was being pushed through. She was with Obama when the Trans-Pacific Partnership was pushed through. So it is clearly she's not any type of critic of these things. And that means all signs point to kind of more of the same, unless there's some sort of on-the-ground movement, because it's not going to come from the top.
256-2001. Give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation between me, Rebecca Kemble, and Steve Horn. We're talking about the new UW chancellor. Well, she's technically hasn't been voted in yet, but the Walker has stacked the UW Board of Regents to the point where I can't see that they would reject the recommendation of the hiring committee. That vote will be taken in April. Yes, and not she is sort of even more than Biddy Martin and more than Donna Shalala. She, as having served in the UW Commerce Department and as its interim head for the last 9 months or so, she has connections at the very top and worldwide, and with all of these corporations that are pushing, and Wisconsin-based corporations actually, like Rockwell Automation, Caterpillar, Oshkosh Trucks, that are pushing for our public education institutions to serve their specific needs.
Correct. Yeah, and I think looking at the very top, like you pointed out, the ties to the Obama administration are really important. Only if you only want to look in one spot, and that's just go south, southeast to Chicago, where just this week, 50 public schools were shut down, where the charter school agenda is being rammed through. And there's connections there. There's the fact that one of the main proponents or one of the groups that's pushing these charters is led, the board of directors is led by Bill Daley, who used to be the chief of staff of President Barack Obama. And look further, and one of the board members of that same group was kind of Penny Pritzker, who was also on the working with the Chicago Public Schools, or she just left because now she's going to work for the administration. Obama is from Chicago. Rahm Emanuel is the mayor of Chicago. He's the former chief of staff. So this agenda, clearly, everyone that she was around is pushing through this agenda in Chicago and beyond. Now, also one more person, Arnie Duncan, leading the Department of Education, also was in the Chicago school system. So she's had basically been in this circle. There's really no reason why she wouldn't continue to push through these reforms, by the way, which are the same reforms that are being pushed by the Walker administration. So it's not as if just because she comes from a Democratic Party administration that the agenda is any different. The agenda is still the same. The language is still the same, and that's the important part.
Right, and I think it does surprise people, and we bring this out in our article that Obama and Walker are in complete agreement, and they both had praise to speak about Blank, and they're both pushing this fiction of the skills gap, which has been debunked time and time again by economists who actually study the labor market. But despite that, with our guest in the first half hour was talking about the power of Wisconsin manufacturers and commerce in Supreme Court races. Well, they also have a huge amount of power in framing the discourse around which public policy takes place. And the skills gap has been it. In fact, I did a little research into where did this term skills gap really come from and when did it start being really pushed? And I found out it was in a study in 2001 by the National Association of Manufacturers, who really started pushing this propaganda. And now it's ubiquitous, and even it's a bipartisan consensus all the way down the line. And now I was just earlier this morning, I was in the Joint Finance Committee where the Department of Public Instruction head Tony Evers was, again, you know, pleading for the life of public education in Wisconsin. And one of the Republican members of the committee said this term, educonomy. And if that doesn't really just encapsulate the whole idea of neoliberal takeover of the very notion of education and public education, I don't know what does. And so this notion of educonomy, where education is instrumental in terms of, you know, its prime function should be to train labor to enter the workforce where the corporations who have power need cheap labor, basically.
Precisely. And yeah, it's a two-pronged thing. So I guess we didn't really tap into this yet, but one of these things that they're talking about with research, it's not just research for research, you know, for the mind. It's a lot of it is commercialization of research. That means, so when I say two-pronged, it means getting cheap labor, getting workers to fill this, quote, skills gap, you know, to fill, you know, to take the positions of in the corporations that are commercializing their research. So it's, they work in tandem. They're not two different things. And you mentioned where this term came from, the skills gap. Well, it came from the National Association of Manufacturers. It spread pretty quickly because one of the things I'm looking into is Kazakhstan, which UW has a partnership with. It's a university called Nazarbayev University. The same term, skills gap, is being used in that country to train its future workers to, you know, work in the oil and gas industry there in the Caspian, or work in the rare earth minerals industry. And it's very, very targeted towards certain industries that will may end up destroying the planet, first of all. Second of all, will provide cheap labor for these people. And then the people who are working at the universities for research may be end up being like upper-level scientists or CEOs someday. So it's not as if any of this agenda is going to help a large portion of the population by any means, although they will use that language and say that it's a form of economic uplift, and that's what's being done in Kazakhstan. But same thing as here, that, you know, people, you know, the economy is bad and we need to fill the skills gap to get these people into these sectors so they have jobs. The truth is that a lot of people are still going to be unemployed because it's just all based on the dictates of what certain big corporations want and not looking at the whole picture of an actual sustainable economy or basically a survivable civilization as we know it based on climate change. It's pretty troubling if you look at the whole picture.
Yeah, really disturbing. And in Wisconsin, the biggest proponent of this rhetoric and policies is Tim Sullivan, former CEO of Bucyrus International, which sold out for $8.6 billion to Caterpillar. They're now the largest mining equipment manufacturing company on the planet. And Sullivan has been given free rein by Scott Walker to completely restructure public education and workforce development in this state. It's quite alarming. He uses a lot of that same rhetoric and really wants to move people into manufacturing. When in fact, the Wisconsin's own data, own Department of Workforce Development data says actually manufacturing jobs in the manufacturing sector are shrinking. And the biggest demand for labor over the next 20 years is going to be in low wage, low skilled, healthcare and retail, industries it's so interesting to look at this, the clash of reality and rhetoric here, and to see nonetheless policy moving forward along rhetorical lines instead of the lines of reality. And just to put a fine point on this, when a piece of legislation called Fast Forward that just passed recently was going through the legislative process. This is a law that provides $15 million in grants to companies to basically subsidize their in-house training programs, and $5 million to create this labor market information software. So Alberta Darling, during the hearings on this bill, actually said everyone knows we have a labor shortage in Wisconsin, which, you know, what a statement when cities like Racine have 11% unemployment. And they just assert these things, and because they have the power, they rule with impunity based on lies, basically, and fantasy. It's so interesting.
Yeah, and you can't, you're not going to see the mainstream media challenge this discourse at all. They just serve the stenographers for the discourse. So it's hard to compete with it. I mean, it still has to be done, but it's very problematic. And,
I challenged a Journal Sentinel reporter the other day when we were sitting in some hearing. I said, are you guys going to publish that UW-Milwaukee report that says the skills gap is false, or are you going to do any critical investigation into this? And he's like, oh, I never heard about that. I don't know. Maybe, you know. So we do have a caller. Caller, go ahead.
Yeah, appreciate all this information and discussion. But I guess to me, the conversation needs to turn, and I'll ask you for the last few minutes of this program to turn in this direction of just how strategies for how to defend what we have, the public investments that we have, and how to match the power that is being bought by the conservatives and the regressive forces. How do we do that when we don't have the same kind of money? What strategies do we use? How do we actually mobilize people? And what are the strategies on the left and the progressive side that are not working? I think it's really time to talk about that. I'd love to hear your thoughts in that direction.
Great question. Thanks a lot. Steve, I know I have some ideas. Do you have any ideas about that?
Sure. Well, I'll start with always a simple three-step formula, and I'll give some more specifics. I think it's always a question of education. I don't know if many people even understand what the skills gap is or any of these neoliberal reforms, like what they are, what neoliberalism is, why it's problematic. There's the whole step of education. Then there's the next two steps, which are agitate and organize. Well, you have to, first of all, get people organized in order to agitate. So first of all, they have to know what it is. Second of all, they have to, get organized, and they have to start inflicting wounds on the powers that be to stop it from happening. A good example is the fact that activists did stop the New Badger Partnership in the spring semester of 2011 because they were doing all these things. There was teach-ins, there was all kinds of writing and sorts of talking about why this is problematic, and then it resulted in basically an occupation outside of the chancellor's office. The chancellor actually probably felt so pressured by everything, and she ended up leaving the university. So it didn't solve the problem itself, but it was a first step while these people are still at the university. I think the students, and especially grad students who understand these things more, have to start getting organized more and start putting themselves on the lines more in terms of activism and doing things that it's really problematic in the university itself, because these grad students are someday looking for a job in the university. It's really a tough situation for them because they have to toe a certain line or they may end up not getting a job as a professor. But I think at some point they have to say, well, look, the future of higher education is going backwards quickly. I may not have a job anyway. We may well have to start thinking about how to reimagine what the university is and what function it serves in society, because right now it's just serving the neoliberal agenda. So I think we're kind of at a tipping point where people like grad students and faculty have to wake up to some of these realities and say, well, are we going to keep continuing within this really flawed system that really doesn't care that much about us, say, like in sociology or humanities or social sciences, or do we push for something different and start really going out there and doing it? Because it's kind of this, like I said, a fine line that they're towing. They may have to cross the line at some point, in my opinion.
I would just put a little finer point on your three points, which is that to really understand that this neoliberal agenda is something that's been going on for decades. It's a struggle that that people have been dealing with in the rest of the world for many, many years, and that part of the education and education is realizing that, and part of the organizing is building coalitions with other forces that are also confronting this. We've got a couple more callers on the air. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question or comment would be this. The new chancellor, as I understand it, is going to be paid roughly $500,000 a year. It seems to me, from a very cynical viewpoint, that the main jobs that the university is able to create are for individuals like her and for the other group of six-figured administrators that are at the top of both the campus and system administration. And the universities are in a very privileged position because so many jobs require a university degree or university training. And yet, even once individuals have obtained the necessary degree or training, they then find that there are very few jobs in those fields. So really, the only people that are benefiting from this whole racket would be the university administrators, whose jobs are virtually guaranteed, and also the banks that profit off the student loans, because so many students necessarily have to become severely indebted in order to obtain the necessary training for jobs which they then may find don't even exist. And
thanks, caller. Yeah, I think that's pretty self-evident. Have we got someone else on the line there, Nigel? Maybe not. So, Steve, any comment on that or any further thoughts on how to confront these forces?
I think the caller brought up a really important point that I didn't bring up, and that is not really going to be talked about unless confronted by the chancellor herself, and that's the whole another piece of this is what's the purpose of undergrads at this university? There's a lot of talk from her about producing research and labor. Maybe that means undergrads will get a job in one of these fields to fill the skills gap. But as far as I understand the skills gap in Wisconsin, this is more pertains to the technical colleges those people serving as the workers. So the question is, what's the purpose of undergrads at the University of Wisconsin? And sort of this omission by her, the reality is the tuition is going up and up and up as the budget is slashed every single budget cycle by both Democrats and Republicans, first Doyle, then Walker. So there's a reality of increasing levels of tuition, which means increasing levels of indebtedness, which means a future of debt is basically one of the worst things that can happen to you, because you either need to get a job in one of these, these big evil corporations that are destroying the planet, or just be in debt and have a whole world of trouble on your hands. So,
yes, as Scott Walker says,
that is a big thing. These debt collectors like Fannie Mae, which are making over $1 trillion off of student loan debt and going up and up every year as people try to achieve the American dream of having a higher education. So it's a tough picture as a whole. It's not bright at all.
It's this whole unvirtuous circle of really subjugating labor and humans to capital. And as Scott Walker says, it's working. All right, we've got one last caller we can get to. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. It's really brief. It's a simple question, but I just first of all wanted to say thanks so much for two really wonderful programs. Would you please specifically define neoliberalism?
Sure. Steve, you want to take a stab at that?
I'll take a stab at it. I may need some help. Basically, it's, from my understanding, it's turning, I mean, some people would say it's just like the most extreme, highest form of capitalism. Basically, it's subjugating everything to the dictates of capital. It means that, look at carbon markets, cap and trade. Carbon can become a commodity. Humans can become a commodity. That's a part of the skills gap. It's looking at humans as capital. There's actually the term human capital. Water can be privatized. Water is a source of a commodity. It's something that corporations can make money off. It's basically turning everything and anything into a commodity. That means
education systems as a whole. Look at charter schools. University of Wisconsin-Madison was almost turned into a private institution under the New Badger Partnership, which would have allowed it to be further commoditized. So I think that's the way I see it. It's just, you know, an extreme form of commodity fetishization, I guess, as Marx would have put it long ago.
And, you know, specifically marked by free trade, you know, by this open market philosophy, free trade agreements, privatization, deregulation, and the notion that markets can take care of anything. And part of the strategies of neoliberalism have to do with killing off the public sector. So, I mean, in Latin America and around the world, actually, we've seen, you know, the privatization of water, the privatization of utilities. And in Wisconsin, we're really at the cutting edge of that, where, you know, the privatization of medical insurance for needy people. You know, this state is at the very forefront of kicking people off Medicare, like one of the last public sector safety net programs we have. So I hope that clears it up.
Last thing I'll say is that there's something known as the Washington Consensus, and we touched on this earlier, but basically this was drawn up about 10 years ago, World Bank basically saying that the Washington Consensus, meaning the Washington meaning the Western world, I guess, or especially the U.S., that the Washington Consensus is neoliberalism. It's this free market, I guess, radicalism, or it's basically everything bends at the will of the, quote, free market, which is never free.
Right, and it used to be just, you know, more evident in foreign policy, but now it's the chickens are coming home to roost. All right, we're coming to the end of our show. I want to thank you very much, Steve Horn, researcher and writer at the DeSmog blog, for joining me today. I also want to thank Bruce Murphy of UrbanMilwaukee.com, whose article on the Supreme Court race is just out in the Isthmus. And thank you, callers, for participating. This was Rebecca Kemble sitting in for Alan Ruff. Have a good afternoon.